cliffcentral.com.
It is just after 7 o'clock, cliffcentral.com on a, what is it, Tuesday morning?
Yeah, we have to Googleize today.
What do you mean?
Well, we Google.
Oh, yes, yeah, so Google's ill, so he's
that
not
thing.
Here.
Yes.
So we're going to catch up in a moment or two with what Pumi's got. We've got some news stories for you today, so you know what's going on in the world.
Mm.
Where shall we begin, Sia?
Well, if we're talking about productivity and trying to be on our way to becoming millionaires and billionaires like we did in part one, mm-hmm. Business Insider South Africa has put together a crunching of numbers to really look at, are we being our most productive selves? So listen to this. This is how much time you waste in traffic.
Oh, God. You're going to tell me this now? I'm having a nice day.
No, we need to learn all of these things so that we make better choices, so that we can be millionaires and billionaires.
You know what I'm looking forward to with December?
Less traffic.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in Johannesburg and Pretoria on any day in December, it feels like heaven. There's no traffic.
Yes.
You can park anywhere you want. It's just magnificent. People want to go to Cape Town. I'm like, what have you? You lost your mind?
To be in the traffic on that small road in Camps Bay.
Aye, boy.
Yes. And everyone, yeah, it's just a mess.
Yeah, and it's all the Joburgers hooting at each other.
Mm. Yeah.
So just in Johannesburg alone, arguably, and of course, one of South Africa's most congested cities,
The
average car commuter in Johannesburg loses 119 hours a year to traffic. Minus the four and carry the one, and how much is that a day?
119 hours a year.
A year to traffic, yes.
So let's figure that out in a way we can understand it. But divide it by 24 hours. All right, so that's...
I think you're already off.
No. 119
hours.
Hours, right?
The 24 so hours
I'm
in a day.
I'm dividing by 24, so we figure out how many days.
To know how many days. Yeah. Got you.
Okay. So it's about five solid days a year.
So see, it wasn't just the sports, hey? It was also the math.
It's 5 days a year that you spend in traffic.
Because this is what they're also stating. If you were to ride a bike, as opposed to being in a car in Johannesburg, just to travel from Daneferne to Sandton on a bike could save you 6 days a year.
Hmm. Well, you'd be also on a bike, though, you take your chances because you could be taken out by some idiot driver and then you save no time a year.
Well, yeah, and there's a smash and grab, which would most likely be like a pull off your bike and grab.
Yeah.
But that would also be 9 days a year if you were getting around in the Cape Town CBD on a bike as opposed to a car.
Okay. So, that's worth thinking about.
You know, I don't live far from Kanego's school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about it, if I should like teach him the route of how to ride his bike to school.
His bicycle.
You'd be okay with that?
I think so. The only problem is kids have so much luggage to take to school.
Yes. Has
he got sports bags and everything?
Yeah, even just his school bag.
Yeah.
You know, like, because we don't have a, what do they, like a locker system.
Yeah.
So he has to take all his stuff. He has to lug it to and from school.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be okay with that. But also the office. So my office, my everyday office is not far from his school either. So kind of once or twice a week, I'll just wear my sneakers and walk down to school.
I'll fetch him from there.
And walk back.
That's cool.
To the office with him.
How long is that walk?
It's about 25 minutes.
Okay.
It's about 2.5 kilometers.
That's not bad. That's good. And it's good exercise. And you know what? You don't need to waste petrol money. No, I like that. That's a good plan.
Yeah, just because we now as well, Business Insider is doing this investigation along with Google, because Google Maps is pushing for a new feature that they've already rolled out in different parts of the world. The same way you can look at, if you're using Google Maps at a commute using the train, or commute when you're walking, or commute when you're driving,
mm-hmm.
you can now see the expected commute when you're cycling or on a bike.
Well,
and this is how they've got to these numbers.
Sia knows this because yesterday we went to a meeting straight after the show, and I don't even use my own brain anymore to navigate the route.
No.
I just hop on there, I go to Waze, and I say, all right, let's see how long it's going to take us. And it invariably gives you the shortest route, least amount of time. I can't imagine a world where we didn't have this. I used to sit stuck in gridlock traffic.
Yeah.
You can avoid that now.
No.
You laughed at me the other day when I said, even when I come here in the morning, I use Waze.
I know.
Because Waze, for me, is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it will sometimes, it could take you through someone's back lounge, right?
Sure.
But
you'll get.
I'm okay with that because I would rather just keep driving than be stuck standing in traffic.
I'm with you.
Right? I'd rather just be moving.
No, I love it. I really do love it. I'm so happy with this technology. Think of how great the world is now.
Yes.
You can hop in the car. You don't have to worry about maybe Rivonia Road will be busy. Maybe the highway's jammed. You just hop in your car and your phone connects to some satellite. You don't have anything to do with it. Next thing you know, you're there shorter, quicker, faster.
So I was driving with my dad the other day. You know how dads, like, I don't know if they like this with, he is 63.
Okay.
I don't know if they like this with their sons, but like, you're never a good enough driver. You don't know where you're going. You know, and my dad is one of those guys that just, because he spent a lot of years on the road, he was a sales rep. So he knows every road in Joburg. He knows every route. He driving with my dad to Meyerton. So I get in the car, I put in my Waze, turn on Waze, it says, take this route. My dad's like, why would you take that route? We should turn left and da, 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 da.
No,
I'm
please.
Just like, I'm not taking your route. I'm taking the route of the artificial intelligence.
And he didn't like that, huh?
My dad is like, yeah, but I think that route is long. I'm like, that route is not long.
Just, you know, like, let me be.
All right, so if you're in my car and you start telling me which route to take, I can drop you off at your car.
Yeah, dad.
And that you can then you can deal with whatever you want.
But you told him this, so what was his response? Did he acquiesce to you and the artificial intelligence?
So he said, it's all right. You know, that's all right. And I was like, okay, let's just time it, Daddy. Don't worry about it. Let's just time it. Let's look at the time. Waze says we will arrive there at this time. Let's see if it really does that.
And it did.
Of course. Waze is like to the minute, you know?
I love
it.
I do.
Then
love
he was
that.
A little bit like,
yesterday when
maybe this thing works.
C and I left here at what, 8:30?
A little after that, like 25.
We had a meeting in the CBD of Sandton, which, you know, is kind of busy. There's always a lot of traffic.
The traffic from here to there at that time.
Right. But we took this route that Waze gave us. We were there exactly at the time it said. We still had 2 or 3 minutes to spare, and we got to our meeting on time, which is great.
But I think I'm teetering on the extreme side of living with technology, because I know there are several places that I've been to over and over again, but without my phone I'd never be able to get there.
I
punch in an address all I'm doing is I'm driving while just taking
you still need to be able to.
You must be Sia, when you're driving you are still operating heavy machinery, and so you have to be alert. You have to be alert. You have to look at what's around you. You have to see everything.
I get that 40,000% and
you
I
just
agree
don't
with
do it.
But I'm so dependent on my technology that if you took Waze away from me.
Yeah, you see what I think what he's saying is this is a
where
problem.
Do I go?
Because if you find yourself unable to navigate without that, like let's say your phone dies, your battery dies or
as
whatever.
As we know, Sia doesn't carry a charger in his car.
Right. So then you
carry my power banks.
So then your phone is dead, and then what? You're screwed.
Here's another example. How many numbers do you know off the top of your head?
This is a problem.
If your phone were to die today, or if your phone were to die on the side of the road, and you somehow flagged someone down, and they were offering their phones to you to call,
I know a lot.
Someone to help. I don't know that many. Very oddly, I know more people. I know your number, Gareth, off by heart, as opposed to, like, I don't know my mother's number off by heart. So you would probably get a call from me to contact my mother.
Yeah, I don't know if I know my mother's.
Hey, Nina.
Isn't it scary?
You can still remember a whole bunch of numbers?
Yeah.
So if you are stuck at a payphone, you don't have your cell phone. Let's say it's been taken off of you. you would know how to get hold of, what, 10 people, 20 people?
Probably 15.
Wow. Okay, well, that's impressive.
15?
That's very impressive.
I could call our WhatsApp line here, Cliff Central.
Yeah.
079-748-2090.
Nina.
And I could call your TV.
Y'all are living on the edge. Y'all are living on the edge and you won't go to space. And that's the kind of edge you're living on.
No, I'm very happy.
I still remember the Yo TV number.
I don't want to go to space. You can keep your space to yourself.
And yet here you are, not remembering your own mother's number.
When I had my small business in Cape Town, I used to drive into the city, park my car, and use my bicycle to go and see some of my clients.
Nice.
The traffic is a mess, and there's never parking anywhere. I had to see my clients. It's quicker by bike if your clients are in the city and the surrounding suburbs. So that comes from Vinny this morning. He's a very smart guy. And guys, my friend came to visit me at home last week and had an actual map book, like an A to Z street map book. That's from Michelle. How do you like that?
Love it.
A map book. I think my dad still uses those. I love looking at maps, don't get me wrong.
I used to love that map book. I used to have one in my car, in my
own. Gets all tattered and torn on the corners. Yeah.
Page 67.
Even more. Yeah, some people are saying that smartphone addiction could be ruining your memory. Well, this proves it. I mean, that we can't remember numbers, you know? It just shows you. Like, I don't think people are able to recall some of the things that we used to be able to recall. But then I think, what do you need to know these numbers for? Let your phone store them. Your brain's got more important stuff to do than worry about that, surely. Right?
Or your brain actually has a way bigger capacity than you are using.
What, you mean for thinking or for storing crap?
Both.
Because honestly, I mean, I could store a lot of useless information, but I don't need to remember phone numbers. But
your brain is a supercomputer. It is like your brain.
Mine or just anyone's? Because I'm telling you, I don't know. Some days I'm not sure.
Simply because you are not using the capability of your supercomputer does not mean it does not have the capacity.
All right, well, listen to this, because this is a guy I've known for some time now, and his story is like something out of a movie. And if you've ever been into pretty much any store in South Africa that sells supplements or any kind of products that, that people who are fit and healthy want to use,
there's
you'll have seen
entire corner in Dis-Chem.
Yeah, and you will have seen USN, right? Now, I saw on your Instagram, his name is Elby Geldenhuys. He's here with us this morning. Elby, first of all, this is the first time I've had you in the studio, but you and I bump into each other all the time at the airport or at the gym or wherever. Mm-hmm. And I've known you for years. And dude, I'm just so blown away by your whole story. We'll get to that in a second. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Gareth. Nice meeting you.
No worries. But I saw you actually designed the USN logo, like on a scrap of paper.
Yeah, the initial idea was to sell a couple of brands as a distributor, and I thought to myself, I'm going to design this logo, you know, that sort of encompasses everything, you know, signs and supplements from across the world. But you know, that's where I saw the opportunity. There was a big difference between the quality of local brands and international brands. So I ended up doing my own thing. And that's where the journey started, end of 99.
Yeah, so 99 you decided to do this. And before that, you didn't have your own business, so you didn't have any like ambitions to start your own brand.
Not at all.
In fact, it's incredible.
It's scary what I knew about business then. The only thing I knew about business was selling health memberships, gym memberships to members at the Health and Racket Club. So I had to learn. It was very stressful but exciting, I guess.
Jeez, look what you've done. So USN now, I mean, you spend half your year in America, more than half.
Yeah, pretty much. This year it's been probably less than half. Last year it was more than half. The year before that, quite a bit more as well.
How many countries are you in now?
We got offices in four continents, but distributing probably to about 100 countries.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Could you ever have imagined this?
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
Dude, this is phenomenal.
To me, when I started the business, I said to myself, you know what, if I could take this product and I can just sell as many units as Toyota sells pickup trucks, then I've got a good business. Yeah. Well, now we're like 200,000 units a month just in South Africa. So,
unbelievable. And it started here in Pretoria, right?
Yeah, that's right, in Pretoria, end of 99.
All right, so take us down. You want to go so, there, Pumps.
Albie, because you never imagined that you could find your product in 100 countries at some point in time, when you wake up in the morning and realize that that's what you've done, what do you think to yourself about your success?
Yeah, you know, you got to always take a step back and, you know, and remind yourself where you've come from. So I do that quite often. But I'm also very careful of patting myself too much on the back, because, you know, it's you got to stay humble as well. And, you know, also it's not just me, you know, I was fortunate to build a very dynamic team over time. And essentially we all built the business
but
together.
I've noticed something about the way that you're extremely loyal to your family for a start, which I think is beautiful. I mean, you really do. You post a lot of really cool stuff about your mom and dad and all the team that you've obviously been around for a long time. And these are guys who might have worked with you since the very beginning.
Yeah.
You still look after everybody, and they're all still, you do fun things together. You all go away on a weekend occasionally together and do something. It's fun.
Yeah, that's right. It's fun. And it's about trust and, you know, and sharing the success. You know, and instead of just taking it for yourself, you know, I mean, everyone in my life contributed to what I've achieved. So I believe we should all share in it.
All right. So I'm thinking about how this whole thing began. You saw a gap in the market here.
Yeah.
And at that stage, you know, probably there weren't that many people who were into fitness in the way that they are now.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly become a thing recently. In the last maybe 15 years or so, it's become a really big deal. And it's become mainstream.
Yeah.
Like people go to gyms. That you look at how many gyms there are now. There weren't that many when you started this business.
Yeah.
And people would just eat what they thought was right then. And that's changed a lot. And, you know, supplements weren't a big deal either.
Yeah. Yeah, well, although at the end of 1999 when I started the business, the market was already saturated. Okay, obviously the market was a lot smaller, but there were quite a few brands already being imported from America, and there were quite a few local brands at that point as well. But you're right, the market was relatively small.
Mm.
So that gave us an opportunity to grow a market and to actually set the trends as well. I always knew to grow the business, we cannot really just rely on bodybuilding. Bodybuilding is just such a small part of the consumer base of sports supplements. It's going to have to be mainstream one day, you know. And I remember the movies we watched when we were kids, and you watch these space movies, or, you know, and a meal is just a little capsule, and so you know,
yeah.
It's almost moving into that direction, not to that extent, but where it's convenience, it's more, well, it's nutritious, and it's really isolating the food into exactly what you need.
You do a lot of research around the products.
Yeah,
you guys put a huge amount of work into what you should be putting in here and what you shouldn't, because obviously there are shortcuts that a lot of people take.
Yeah.
To get high protein content into food.
That's right.
And some of it's just really awful stuff.
Yeah.
It's like just mashed up, you know, dead animals or whatever else it might be. So you have to be very careful what you put in here, right?
Right. Yeah, well, we are very fortunate. The fact that we are based across the world, you know, we've got such a lot of amazing resources and labs that help us develop these products. You know, it's so we're not only just dependent on our own research and development. We've got access to big companies internationally who help us produce these amazing products. I mean, these bars that I just brought you as an example, that's produced by a specialist protein bar company in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, to pack in 20 grams of protein into
amazing.
A bar that tastes incredible with only 1.6 grams of sugar. I mean, you got to taste that. You will never think that it's good for you.
No sugar.
Well, only 1.6
grams, Pums. It's less than you can fit on, what, like your little fingernail. That's really
That's
cool.
Right, yeah.
And was it hard getting into America, getting into the different countries? Everybody's got different regulations.
Yeah.
And it's different from home. It's different from South Africa. It's not, you know.
So it's always, there's always that hard element, even when I started, because I didn't really know what the hell I was doing. all I knew was I'm gonna find suppliers to produce these products that I've got this idea. I'm getting a pharmaceutical company and they're gonna produce what my idea is. So fortunately, because we got the best suppliers, we got the best product. It's always hard, but because I came from such a low base and because I had nothing to lose, I was a cop. I earned 1,800 rand a month. That was my last salary after 600. After 6 years, felt like 600 years. 1,800 rand. I didn't think it wasn't a lot of money. I thought it was more than enough because it's just the fact that I didn't make the end of the month was my own fault. So after that, joining the Health and Racket Club, I made a little bit more. But then I learned a little bit about business and customer relations and so on as well. And that I applied into my business. So in January 2000, the turnover of the company was 20,000 rand. And I thought to myself, geez, I've really got a business here. 20,000 rand turnover. I've sold 20,000 rand worth of products this month. In April, the sales were 160,000. Now I'm looking at figures that I've never seen in my life before. Because a couple of years before that in the police force, I earned, 30,000 rand a year.
So exponential salary. Growth.
100%, yeah.
I also got into the rabbit hole. After receiving my running order, and now I'm like, oh, looking up, who's this guy? What's he up to? I love the image of you and your little Sputnik.
Yeah.
Like, how did you come up with the formulation? So you were a cop, you were a salesperson at the Health and Racket Club, and now you're mixing stuff make a nutritional supplement. Come on, that's not like just...
Okay, so in school I didn't really do well. I just had so many things on my mind that I wanted to do. So, and because I didn't study much in school, I guess I had a lot of free capacity in my brain that I could use thereafter. So,
free up that space.
So I started getting into the fitness and the gym thing, I started educating myself about amino acids, what it does, how exactly it works and so on. So I really developed a very, very keen interest in it. And because I could share that information, I was always the guy that was called by my friends in the Blue Bulls and so on. What supplements, what ingredients can we put together? And that's actually where I thought, I could actually start a business, not thinking that it's going to be a big business, thinking I'm going to mix the stuff at home and sell it to my friends. Obviously, the formulations were based on research and products that's already developed in America and trends and so on. So I always made the formulations a little bit stronger than what's already out there. Obviously, the guys got great results. So, I ended up putting a label on it.
And it became Ultimate Sports Nutrition. And now you've got this business, which is international. How much of the running of it is still hands-on up to you? And where is the hardest part of running this? Is it in distribution? Is it in the actual formulation, making new products, marketing? What's the hard part?
I'd say the hard part is probably the part where I'm not that comfortable, the part that I don't enjoy. But the hard part for me is the easy part for someone else.
So what parts don't you do?
So I don't enjoy the financial part of it. I don't enjoy the administration. I don't enjoy sitting in an office all day long. I want to make things happen. I like the creative part of it. I like the formulations, and the marketing side of it.
Right. And the new products which you're always launching. So with the financial stuff, do you let someone else do most of that for you, and then you get a report every day, every 2 days, every 3 days or whatever, and you check the numbers out, and if it makes sense to you, then you let them carry on with whatever they're doing?
Yeah, 100%. Obviously, we've always had a relatively strong, initially financial team, now a very strong financial team. The MD is also a chartered accountant, which helps a lot, and he's got his MBA as well. And he oversees the entire financial structure of the business internationally. So that takes that pressure off of me.
Because a startup business is very different to a business that's grown to the proportions that yours has.
Yeah.
You can't be the guy who started the business 10 years down the line. It's a different animal, right?
Yeah. So initially, yes, I needed to do everything. I needed to do the invoicing. I needed to do the finances. Yeah. I even when things became very stressful, I went down to the little warehouse and I started packing orders. Put products in boxes, put it in the delivery vehicles, and then as soon as the stress is over, I go back to the office and I deal with the office stuff again. So I needed to do absolutely everything in the first couple of years. It was extremely stressful, but extremely exciting because, again, of the low base that I've come from. So there was always this growth, you know. So for me, what keeps things exciting is the continuous growth. The moment that you start, you feel there's a bit of a plateau, you look for new growth opportunities again. Because there's one thing I believe in, a business can never hover. You either go forward or you go backwards. So to make sure you go forward, make sure you go forward at a good pace.
So Albie, in all of this, you're saying eat, sleep, breathe, live this business for the first however many years it was, and probably still to some degree. But are you able to actually enjoy your life in between? Because I hear about like Elon Musk, and he says he doesn't take vacations because he says vacations are bad for you and bad things happen on vacation.
Bad things have happened to him.
Like he was ousted from his own company and a whole lot of other stupid stuff happened because he was taking a break and he never took breaks.
Yeah.
And I always wonder, like, there's a balance to be achieved here. Yeah. I mean, how old are you now?
46.
46. I mean, you don't look it, so
thank you.
you don't have to worry about that. But you've got to enjoy your life while you're making the money, because otherwise you're going to find yourself at 60 or 70 years old, and you may have $1 billion in the bank.
Yeah.
But what do you got to show for it? You know, yeah. In terms of happiness. So what do we got? We got family. We got kids. We got we've got fun.
Yeah. No, I initially it was difficult.
Yeah.
Holidays were difficult. I just absolutely hated weekends. I couldn't believe when it's Friday already and I just got my pace going for the week, and now I'm sitting stuck with the weekend again. And then and public holidays were the absolute worst for me.
Opposite of what most people think.
Yeah, I know. And I'm thinking back now, I think to myself, geez, I actually did work very hard at one point. But at that point, I didn't think I'm working hard enough. Mm-hmm. I just thought I'm not productive enough. There's a lot more we can do. Mm. You know, and for me, another very frustrating thing was being on an airplane for 10 hours, you know, because I need to make things happen and I can't communicate with anyone. It was just extremely frustrating. So, but those are the type of things we learn from. You learn, you know, and also fortunately, when as the business develops, there's more structure in the business. There's more people that you can rely on, you know, and balance. And, you know, as difficult as it may be initially for, you know, when you start your business and that's the only thing that you want to focus on, you've got to find that balance.
Yeah. So I mean,
so that's what I do.
But you've got kids.
Yeah.
How old are they now?
So my oldest boy is 16, 17 actually.
Wow. Turning, okay.
Yeah. Sure. And my daughter is 13 and my youngest boy is 11. So... And yeah, it's incredible how time flies. Yeah.
Your eldest must know that, I mean, he must have experienced some of the life
days
before all of this tremendous success too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's, and also, you know, at that point, I was 29 when Albie was born, 30 actually. And yeah, you know, it's, you at such a high pace at that point is that you really want to give, you know, spend a lot more time with your kids and you're always going to regret not doing it. But he sort of remembers that he's grown. And, I mean, since he can remember, there's always been USN, you know, so.
It's his other parents.
And
were you that parent that took your child with you to the warehouse, to the office, was he part of kind of growing up with this thing?
Yeah, I took him a couple of times and so on, but his mom was a bit of a helicopter mom, you know, very protective over him and so on. So she probably didn't want him to be too affected by this USN cult, as she saw it. But I mean, there's always been a fair USN influence to him, and I think he's going to finish school next year. So hopefully I get him involved in the business after his studies.
So a little earlier, we were just talking about the Waltons,
yep,
right? And all the money that they got from their parents.
Yeah.
But also, interestingly, they also work within the organization, right? Yeah. Are you building a generational family business.
Yeah, well, so when I started the business, that, you know, I didn't know where to find people. So it was all my friends and all my family, they all got jobs. You know, so some of them kept up with the pace and there were some casualties, unfortunately. If you look at the top structure of the business now, both my sisters and my brother works for me. You know, my friends who started with me at the end of 99, beginning 2000, most of them are still in the business. Yuri Besaidnot, who runs the business internationally, he started in 2010, came from PSG. So he's basically one of the latecomers. But that who's also made a significant contribution to the growth of the business. So yes, it's basically family and friends, a lot of family and friends, and whoever came later became family and friends.
That's magnificent. Well done.
Okay, so when you're in America, are you there to work, or do you have a whole life there as well?
Yeah. So it really just depends on how much time I'm going
to
spend.
I'm trying to figure out how you compartmentalize your life, because you do spend a lot of time here as well, right? And you're very connected to what's going on in South Africa.
Yeah.
But you obviously have to divide your time up. So how does that work?
So in the US, I generally wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to still have this window of communication with South Africa and England. So the first thing I'll do, I'll wake up, I'll communicate for about 2 hours, emails, phone calls, and so on. And it really works well for me because it's quiet and there's no other interference. And I can really focus at that point. 6 o'clock, I'll go for a run and a bit of a workout, and I'll come back, get ready, and then I'll go to the US office. And then obviously a good couple of hours in the US office. But then the nice thing is when I get home at 8 o'clock, I'm out. I sleep until I wake up, and that's the routine basically when I'm in the US.
Yeah, a lot of people tell me that a routine is a very important thing to establish if you're going to be successful too. And you know, this in your case may be true. For a lot of other people it is as well.
Yeah.
That they make sure that they, you know, go to sleep at the same time, they eat the right food in the right window, they get enough sleep, they do a bit of exercise. This stuff matters.
But also how much work is in that routine. So how much of your time you actually spend still working.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people, we have this notion that when you make money or when you have a successful business, like the business runs itself. Yeah. People are running the business and you're just going to, I don't know.
Well, you are very fortunate when you got a business that runs itself. But in that case, normally what happens is by the time you realize this business is not being run anymore, it's too late. Mm. Because then you want to step in, and then the ship has been heading for the iceberg and is probably hitting at that point. Mm. You know, and in that case, it's normally, you know, you lose your fitness for your game. Mm. You lose your fitness for your business and for the industry. So once you disconnect with your business and someone else runs it for you, you're very fortunate if it can happen, but it really does sustainably happen. Mm. Yeah.
And how, what's the next step for you and for the business?
Yeah.
Where would you like to see things go now?
So,
because there's always that pressure, right? Someone's always asking you, so what's next?
What's next?
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
I can't even believe where I've got to. But yeah. You want me to talk about what's next?
It's probably one of the questions that I remember from even 20, but way before I started the business, people always ask you, so where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? Well, I cannot tell you where I see myself in 5 years' time. It will be growth, that's for sure. I'll be much further ahead than where I am now. How exactly that's going to happen, I don't know. You know, because it's when you pour water down a mountain, you don't know exactly how it's going to flow, it's going to flow in a certain direction.
But do you remember the magic moment? Do you remember the magic moment where it all turned? So there was incremental growth. Mm. So, you know, you made 20,000, you made 100. But do you remember the magic moment that for you went, my goodness, this thing is bigger than I ever thought?
Those moments were always there. They always were. There were never one moment where I thought that. I always thought to myself, I've just got to keep on growing. I've just got to keep on growing. I've got to find the opportunities to keep on growing. I've got to make sure that whatever we're doing as right as possible, so the foundation is very strong. But I've got to be 100% honest. They were never. It was always these small goals, and a lot of them all the time.
That's important.
Yeah, I never took big chances because I, because big risks. I never saw myself as this fantastic, great businessman, and I was always realistic about the fact that maybe I'm just really good at selling sports supplements. So maybe I must just keep on doing this very, very well and not gamble too much.
Yeah.
You know, so
because people get ahead of themselves, they start thinking, "Well, I've had success here, so maybe I'd also be a brilliant investor."
Yeah,
and then they start investing in other people's companies, and it's a disaster.
Well, they sell their business, and they sit with all of this cash, and they go and buy a business that they didn't understand.
Yeah,
you know, and then that's all gone.
Good point.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, you must have met some really interesting people on this journey. Are there people that you still want to meet? Are there people that you could not believe you have met in your career so far?
Yeah, I've actually met a lot of very interesting people. But what I've learned about people as well, it doesn't matter what success you've achieved, they all just really like you and me, you know, and anyone else, and my brother and my dad, and, you know, there's just so much resemblance in anyone, and, you know, and the most successful people are generally, from what I've, my experience, the most humble people as well, and you see why they've achieved this success. So, I won't say there's specifically people that I'd love to meet.
But it's interesting, too, that you're in a business where it doesn't matter how wealthy you are, you have to look after your own body. You have to look after your own health. Isn't that fascinating?
And you cannot really throw money at the problem.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody,
what do you mean you can't throw money at the Kardashians? Have you not seen the Kardashians?
No, but I mean, people have to go and that you have to do your own work. You have to. Yeah. I see you in the gym sometimes, and it's you're there training hard like everyone else.
But that's the first thing I said to him when I saw him. I was like, dude, you know what I thought you'd look like? I thought you were going to be like those big, muscly guy. Here you are.
Well, he is.
Well, I'm like the blend between a muscly guy and a cyclist. Because I like doing both.
Do you cycle? So what's your fitness regime?
Right now, I would just really, you know, try and get to gym like 3 days a week for half an hour, 40 minutes. And otherwise, I'll just go for a 40 minutes run in the morning, slow run. It's more what you eat than the exercise that you do in any way. If you eat healthy, then that's 80% of the solution.
So then the follow-up question is, what's the ultimate kind of regime in terms of sports supplements if a person wants to be optimally healthy?
So there's so many different goals. Firstly, you know, to be optimally healthy is to have a good balanced eating plan, just to eat healthy. That's the first and most important thing. So what supplements does, that's going to enhance your results. So whatever your goal is, it's going to make your life easier. You know, drinking 2-3 shakes, protein shakes during the day, because you don't have time to go and have a meal. Taking a bit of creatine just to give you that strength in the gym and volumize the muscle. So it really just depends on what your goal is. But to live a very healthy lifestyle in the ideal world, it's having 4-5 very balanced meals.
Huh.
4-5 very balanced meals
during the day. But that's in the ideal
small
world, which we
meals.
Don't live in anymore.
Well, here's a question for you from Leanne. She says, what happened to the USN Trust Crunch birthday cake bar? It was delicious and I can't seem to find it anywhere anymore.
What? There's a birthday?
Yeah, she's cake obsessed.
There's
she's
a birthday obsessed. Cake?
Well,
wait a minute.
Yeah, so the birthday cake, we've got cycles. So whenever our next birthday comes along again, we'll have the birthday cake. The birthday cake bar is actually produced in America. These bars are produced in
Germany.
In Germany, yeah. And unfortunately, the shelf life of the birthday cakes are a little shorter. So
life? So, because I was about to ask you, how long, if I bought like this pack, right? So how long could I keep it in my pantry?
You could probably keep that about a year.
Therefore, the next time the birthday cake supplement comes up, young lady, you better buy 12
buying
boxes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, LB, listen, congratulations on everything that you've achieved with USN and the fact that you've helped so many other people along the way, because business is fine and we all understand that success speaks for itself. But it's so great to see that there are people who are taking their health seriously, taking their fitness seriously. They use this stuff. It's part of their lives. And That, I suppose, is a feeling that's even more a feeling of accomplishment than...
It's very rewarding, yeah.
You know, than the bank balance, which well, I mean, well done. Yeah, it's terrific.
Thank you very much, Gareth. Congrats, yeah, it was awesome to be here.
Yeah, I'm sorry it's taken so long for us to sit down and talk like this, because we've been threatening for years. All right, it's time for Blind History Season 2, Episode 9. We're talking Albert Einstein this morning. Of course, the image of a brilliant scientist, one that's inextricably linked to a picture of him in your head, you know, the unkempt hair and the shabby jacket, the twinkle of genius in the eye. The story of Einstein isn't just one-dimensional, though. His relationships, his politics, even the story of what happened to his brain, Pumi, after he died, are as intriguing as the great ideas he presented to science and the world. Here it is, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. It is Albert Einstein and Blind History, Season 2. The origin of the universe, the nature of everything we know, the meaning of space and time, and an equation to make sense of everything. These were the enormous preoccupation of Albert Einstein and his genius mind. By the time he died, he'd helped humankind understand some of the most complex concepts in physics.
But his brain ended up in a glass jar of formalin on a shelf. And the man who possessed it sliced off pieces of the most famous brain of all time for anyone who wanted some.
Blind History. We're in Season 2 and we're talking about a bunch of people. Some of them are leaders, some of them are kings, some of them are warriors, but some of them are just brilliant minds. And there can't be a more brilliant mind than the guy we're about to talk about now. In fact, when people go, "You're a genius," they sometimes say, "Oh, you're an Einstein." That's how much of an effect he had on the 20th century and physics in the 20th century. But he's probably the smartest guy in recent living memory, right?
I think the greatest mind of his time.
For sure. And he was a big fan of Isaac Newton, who came before him. But he then went on to challenge Isaac Newton. He grew up in very humble beginnings, and his parents didn't actually expect much of him.
They didn't really, and they were Jewish. But they weren't practicing Jews, so there was no pressure on religion. His dad was a sales guy and also involved in electric motors, and he did very well in the early years. And he fell on hard times because the innovation was so fast and turning so much that he actually wasn't going on the right path. So that changed everything actually for Albert Einstein, because they moved down to Italy and they left him there.
Well, he ran away from school.
Correct. That's when that happened, yes.
Of course, this all happening in Germany, where he would eventually go back and then eventually renounce his citizenship. But at this stage of the story, so young Albert Einstein is the least promising of their children. I think they had a nickname for him, Der Depperte, which is the dopey one.
Correct. And he didn't actually speak until he was three.
He was the dopey one?
Yeah.
God help us, the rest of the family had ever gone and studied physics. We might have solved all the world's problems. So he ran away from school, wasn't a good student, joined his family in Italy again.
But I think just to point that from a student perspective, he didn't even have to really listen in class because he was so bright. But he was quite hectic to his teachers. He didn't show respect. He ignored them. And later on, they would come and bite him because he couldn't find a job for 9 years later on because none of the professors wanted to hire him. But that was what he was like. He was actually quite a difficult person to teach.
Yeah, I think his happiest years were probably when he was studying at Zurich University. And he was able to kind of explore some of these areas in physics and chemistry that he was interested in. But he wasn't the top of the class. You know, even in the end of high school, his results were pretty ordinary. And I don't think anyone would have guessed at that stage this would become the greatest theoretical physicist of the 1900s. When he finished that, he took up a very boring job as a patent clerk in
Switzerland.
He was just filing these really dull papers all the time and had no fun in his life at all. He had at that stage met a woman called Mileva, who he'd fallen in love with. But they had a very weird relationship, which we can get into in a minute. Either way, this boring job gave him a chance to ask himself questions about space and time and how things work. And there was a big clock tower in the town, and he would sit and imagine, he would do thought experiments, as he called them, what would happen to the clock if you traveled away from it at the speed of light. the kinds of things that only really brilliant people think about. And he started filing papers then with the major scientific journals. And for a long time, there was no reply, and he was very downcast and miserable and depressed about it. And, you know, his marriage wasn't exactly fantastic either. I think he liked her because she was also a physicist. She was the only woman studying physics.
Correct, Serbian physicist, yeah. Mm. So it stimulated his mind.
And there's a rumor that they had a daughter, and that they may have either given her up for adoption or she might have died of scarlet fever when she was very young. But it didn't sound like things were totally kosher there for a long time. She did eventually produce two sons for him, one of whom was very depressed. And I think he might even have been permanently in an asylum after his mother died. But that whole situation unraveled later on when he moved back to Germany.
But if we have to look just a little bit back to when he was at school, just briefly, he always shot lights out on sciences and maths. So he was always top of the class. So that's often not true what they say. First of all, he didn't want to be in the conscription because the Germans were now... That's what they were doing, and he was a pacifist. So that's why he ran away, one of the reasons he ran away to Italy, to where his parents were. But also he had the thought of mind to get a letter of recommendation from his maths and science teacher, which he used to actually get into the institution in Switzerland, and that actually got him in. He didn't really care about the other subjects, and that's where he might have not done well, such as languages and those type of things. But the sciences, he was absolutely already from an early age, they could see to write a letter of recommendation that you could actually see that this guy had something seriously special.
I think the most interesting story I heard about that period of his life was when he was friends with a lot of these other brilliant scientists, right? So he stayed with Fritz Haber in Germany when he was there. He was the guy who developed the Haber process and eventually chlorine gas, which was used in World War I. And they didn't see eye to eye on that. And Fritz Haber's life was a mess after that as well, because it was weaponized, you know. He weaponized his chemistry. But he was good friends eventually with Max Planck, who he'd sent one of his articles to.
Which we're still studying the Planck theory today, correct?
Absolutely. And Max Planck had a very, very powerful reputation in Germany in the sciences. And actually, Kaiser Wilhelm II, who started World War I, effectively, or certainly fought against the Allies during World War I as the main protagonist, he asked Max Planck to set up an institute in Berlin and to recruit the best scientists he could find to work in the pre-war effort and then during the war as well. And this was a big break for Einstein. He was asked to go there by Max Planck. By that stage, he had already won a Nobel Prize, or he was on his way to winning a Nobel Prize for one of the three papers he'd already written.
But funny enough, not the theory of relativity. So no, he was quite upset about that.
He was, and he would eventually get recognition for it.
But I think he got it for protons or something like that.
It was to do with atomic theory. And I mean, we are not in a position to get into the kinds of stuff that he was writing there. I think we'll hurt ourselves if we start. But either way, he eventually said to Max Planck, and it's quite a cute story, he said, "I'm going to go home and think about it. When I come back to Berlin, if I'm carrying red flowers, it means I've accepted the job. If I'm carrying white flowers, it means I've changed my mind. I want to go back to Switzerland instead." And you had these two, I think Max Planck and one other guy, were standing at the railway station hoping that Einstein, who'd by then become quite famous for some of his published papers, they were waiting for this guy to get off the train to see what color the flowers were. And he walked up with the red flowers and said, "I'll take the job." And did some really interesting work in Berlin for that time. But he was, as you say, a pacifist. And increasingly, as it became obvious that Germany was going to war, that he would be roped into this, he became less and less interested in what they were doing for Kaiser Wilhelm and kind of reclusively went into his study. And he did a lot of really important work during that time. And some of it eventually would lead to, you know, prizes and recognition for him. But his marriage had broken down as well.
Talking about the white flowers and the red flowers, that was a driving point for him to go to Berlin, actually.
Yeah.
Because
the flowers weren't actually for Max at all. They were for his cousin, for Elsa.
Exactly. So he took his wife across there, and then he unceremoniously, it was quite hard in the way he approached it. He basically said, "You'll still be my wife, but you'll have certain duties and we won't live together." And so she accepted it. And then in the end,
certain duties, he said, you will make this meal and that meal for me when you see me. This is what I want. You'll keep the children quiet while I'm studying. I mean, it was like, it was
hardcore.
Yeah, it was very hardcore stuff. And he had fallen in love with his cousin. Mm. And he promised Mileva as part of the settlement, he said, if you divorce me, you can have the money from my first Nobel Prize that I get. And she didn't know whether he would win a Nobel Prize or not. And he didn't know, frankly, but he was that confident. Mm. And when he did win his first Nobel Prize, he did give her the money.
What made him such an interesting person was he was charismatic. He would flirt a lot with women. And also, he was not only just a scientist, he was a philosopher. And, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, you don't talk science and religion, but he had some very strong opinions on religion. Okay, yes, when he was at a Catholic school, when he was young, he became religious, but he saw, obviously, the more he understood science, less as such, but he always believed in a higher power. He always believed that nature works in a certain way, and it's structured in a certain way, and people called him an atheist. He was never an atheist.
He called himself an agnostic. He certainly said there's no such thing as a personal God, but his views on religion are controversial now because people interpret them whichever way they want to.
Correct.
He used to say things
to suit
like,
their cause.
He'd say, God does not play dice. And by that, he means that there are structures and equations and formulae that make the universe what it is. Mm. And that those things, he was keen to understand the mind of God. But he didn't mean the kind of God that has a problem with you wearing these kinds of underpants.
Yeah.
You know, he was more interested in the laws of the universe, the laws of physics. And certainly he saw patterns which he thought were probably not coincidental.
And that's what he was working towards when he died for the rest of his life, basically, was to try to work out
the universal theory of everything.
Exactly. And he died actually doing it. The notebook was next to his bed when he finally passed away. But from a religious perspective, what was very important to him was he said, we don't want the human being to be good in fear of being punished. We want the human being to be good because they are good or want to be good.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, because he was so brilliant, expected him to also speak about everything. And there were a couple of things that he was driven by. He loved music. He could play the violin very well. He was also a Zionist. He believed that the Jewish people needed a homeland. And he was offered the presidency of Israel.
3 years before his death, yeah.
That's right. He said, look, you know, with all the love in the world, I'm a humble scientist. I can't do it. Which in some ways tells you that there was real humility there. But because he was brilliant, they expected him to know everything about everything. Mm. He was also a very strong campaigner in the days when it wasn't fashionable to be a campaigner against racism.
All inequality.
Yeah. He thought that America was still very racist and backward and not necessarily where they should be in terms of progressive ideas.
And also on the gay side in Europe, he was very on the equality on the gay side.
So he did a lot. And for his time, he delivered way more than people would have expected. I mean, his scientific theories were brilliant. He actually corrected his special theories of relativity. They were going to, during a solar eclipse, measure whether the light bent around the sun effectively. And because of World War I starting, his experiments were never conducted. And after that, they were all upset that the experiments couldn't be done because it wouldn't be able to prove him right. And eventually they discovered that if those experiments had been done, they wouldn't have proven what he wanted. And he had to adapt his theory, despite not having the evidence of the experiments, and found that he had been in some areas wrong and corrected those things about how, for example, things don't bend around. It's got to do with space and time. It's got to do with the fact that gravity is not a pull, but it's a push. And there are all sorts of things that he added to theoretical physics, which up to then were considered crazy. And these were the seminal ideas that made it possible for us to eventually build the atomic bomb and power up nuclear reactors and figure out what happens in the universe, what large bodies in the universe are doing.
So to that point, in 1905, when he produced five papers, of which the theory of relativity was one of them, the scientific community didn't accept it. I mean, they thought, who's this upstart? We don't believe it. And it was only in 1920 that they started, this is incredible and what he's done and what he's achieved. But funny enough, late in life, he became that person. He became the old school. And he was quite stubborn because he was working towards the universal theory of relativity till the day he died. And whatever people were saying or mentioning, he said, no, that's not what it is. But he was also very honest in what he...
And quite eccentric. Saying. I mean, like, when we think of a mad genius now, we think of, like, Einstein hair and, you know, it's kind of the way that people portray a scientist. And he was a bit eccentric. Like we said, he used to play his violin. A lot of his ideas came when he was either playing the violin or sleeping. And I believe he used to sleep 10 hours a night or a day, which is a lot.
We need to learn from that, maybe.
I'm not sleeping near that. But I'm no genius. Yeah. And it was quite weird. Like, he didn't really have great family relations. And he had lots of friends in the scientific community. He was friends with Sigmund Freud, among others. Charlie Chaplin said something interesting about him, and you mentioned his fame just a minute ago. Chaplin said, "The people applaud me because everybody understands me. They applaud you because no one understands you."
He knew exactly who he was. He liked his quiet time. He was a loner, but he also loved the limelight, and he loved being with people. So he just, whenever it suited him, he would do whatever he felt. He loved going for walks, and I think that's a big part of his creativity. From a young age, he used to walk into the mountains in Germany and in Switzerland later on, and then, as we hear, even in Princeton he walked.
Yeah, he used to walk to and from Princeton every day. He would smoke his pipe the whole time, so the students knew it was him because they'd see the cloud of smoke.
They honored him. The Smoking Society honored him, and he said, smoking brings a clearer thought and calmness.
Do you know who else honored him? It was the Plumbers Association, because he said he really admired plumbing. He admired plumbers. He thought plumbers were good people who did good work, and he became the honorary president of the Plumbing Association. Okay. Or something. Yeah.
And then also, strangely, he never wore socks.
Oh.
Even in the middle of winter, he never wore socks. So he was...
Very strange guy.
Yeah, so he had a lot of quirky habits. But the atomic bomb was released. That really killed him. It took a long time. I don't know if he ever did get over it.
He did say his biggest mistake was writing that letter to President Roosevelt. Correct. And saying we need to arm up against the Nazis and build this atom bomb faster than them. But I think, you know, history's proven he was probably right.
And he actually did mention it. If he knew that Germany wasn't going to build an atomic bomb, he would have kept quiet.
Just to reflect on that World War II period, he did something interesting too, which I don't think a lot of people know about. He actually found work for all the Jewish German scientists in England and in Turkey, funnily enough, during the time when there were, you know, they were starting to ratchet up the anti-Semitism there. And he managed to save over 1,000 Jewish scientists. The world would have never known about their work if he hadn't personally got involved and petitioned. Like, he was quite close to the Belgian royal family. And that's how he actually got hold of President Roosevelt eventually about how we need to scale up this bomb initiative. But his brain has an interesting history of its own, because after he died, they performed an autopsy, and the doctor, I think his name was Harvey, who performed the autopsy, actually took out Einstein's brain, put it in a jar, and used to cut pieces off and give them to other scientists to study, to see if they could figure out whether Einstein's brain was different to any other person's brain. They determined in the end there were more glial cells, and he had slightly more synaptic activity in certain parts of the brain, but that essentially a brain's a brain. And it was more that this guy was just really connected to what was going on. He had a great imagination.
He was so curious, and he was just such a dynamic and with different facets in his character. So he was helping the Jewish scientists. There was actually a bounty on his head from Nazi Germany, and they confiscated his house and all his money.
Well, Hitler turned his house into a Nazi youth camp. A Hitler youth camp, and they confiscated his sailboat, which Einstein was really pissed off about. Yeah. He did not like that at all.
Because
he didn't like them after they took his sailboat.
But he couldn't swim.
Yeah.
So he didn't
he would sail, but he couldn't swim.
And he would often turn upside down. When he's in Princeton, he would be sailing out at sea, and they always had to rescue him because he wasn't a great sailor, but he loved sailing, and he couldn't swim at all. So those were the challenges. Wow. And then there always has to be our dear, dear friend that we hear in so many different stories. J. Edgar Hoover was investigating him.
Well, they kept files. I think they eventually had like 1,000 files on Einstein, because he was buddy-buddy with the socialists, and then he was talking to the pacifists.
Yeah, he was a communist.
And J. Edgar Hoover kept an eye on everybody.
He did. 100%.
We've got to do an episode on him one day. Well, there he is, Einstein, a genius, a person who contributed more to modern physics and our understanding of how the universe works than almost anybody, and a bit of a nutcase as well. Thanks
Thanks for listening to the award-winning Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. CliffCentral.com